Hello, Navy fans, and welcome back, regretfully, I'm sure, to the second edition of the Bird Dog Podcast. My name is Mike James. I am coming to you from the Casa de Bird Dog in Jacksonville, Florida. I am joined once again by Andy Schmickel here, coming to you from the Free State. Andy, how are you doing?
I'm doing just fine, thank you.
Splendid. Well, this was supposed to be a fun episode of the podcast. We were going to talk about football stuff and position battles and practice and the stuff we like to talk about. But news has a way of ruining all of that. And there were a couple of items of particular interest over the past couple of weeks that kind of sapped all the fun out of everything. We'll get to Air Force in a little bit. But Andy, I think we're going to start with some big changes on the way in the NCAA, both with the Power Five conferences getting the green light to go ahead with autonomy and making their own rules, and also, and a little bit later, a couple days after that, we had the ruling on the O'Bannon case, which dealt with the players and their name, image, and likeness as used by the schools. And well, let's start with the background of O'Bannon first, for those who might not really understand what was going on. O'Bannon was a class action lawsuit that was filed originally against the NCAA, Electronic Arts, the video game publisher, and the Collegiate Licensing Corporation, about those entities using player names, image, and likenesses, and not compensating the players for it. And as the trial went on, it started to encompass a whole range of tangential items along those lines, but also really called into question the NCAA's very definition of amateurism, and a whole bunch of different issues. But the ruling came down, and it was kind of limited in scope, Andy, I think, but it still probably has some significant impacts to what we would call the little guy, in terms of what, you know, some separation, the impact in terms of what the separation is going to end up being between the haves and the have-nots.
Yeah, and you know, the judge came down, and the big takeaway from her ruling was that the NCAA essentially was in violation of some antitrust laws, but she didn't go so far as to kind of blow the entire NCAA up. In fact, what ended up really getting passed down was a minimum of $5,000 a year on payments to athletes that could be paid and fit within the broader framework of what was going on. And this only applies to football and basketball because those were what made up the plaintiffs. So that almost kind of falls in line with this organic movement from the Power Five schools to move towards a cost of attendance as it is anyway. I believe that this $5,000 a year would be put into a trust until to be paid after the athlete leaves the school. I don't know if graduation rate or, you know, if actually graduating plays into it or anything like that. And it's $5,000 to be paid evenly to everybody. Like a five-star athlete can't get more than the two-star athlete kind of thing. So there's some intricacies. I mean, I know the New York Times editorial page wrote that the one thing missing from the 100 pages or 99 pages that was written was clarity. So I'm sure there'll be a lot more that gets figured out over the coming months before this is supposed to be implemented. But so we'll see where it goes. But it's definitely a move towards starting to divide the schools who can afford to pay that and those who can't.
And I think, you know, if you really look at, in the case of O'Bannon here, especially when you look at something like his grievance against Electronic Arts and the Collegiate License Corporation, which those two actually settled beforehand, but I think that he had a pretty good point you know, we both played NCAA football. You know, we see the players that are on there. They look like the players that are on the team. They sure. A lot of times they'll list the same numbers, the same hometowns. You know, it's clearly the image of that player. And yeah. So
I mean, I was gonna say just real quick, there was even a case of in one of the NCAA football games, there was a play in the Florida playbook that used the word Tebow in the right. file structure of it. I mean, it became blatantly obvious that, yeah, okay, this is going on to some degree.
Right. And well, we've seen a lot of stories come out since then about, well, the players, a lot of the players, you've had a lot of interviews with a lot of the players in college football now, and they just want the game. But while you can sympathize with that, what they want and what they're legally entitled to are really two different things. So I think there was some very legitimate concerns here. I do have some issue with the way. I don't think the NCAA did a very good job really defining their own, making their own case, really.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of commentary going on during the trial that NCAA witnesses were almost making the case for the O'Bannon witnesses at some point. And, so needless to say, that certainly did not help them out.
No, but in a lot of ways, I wonder if that's a case of the NCAA just falling all over itself, or is that just how we heard things through the filter of who was sure. giving us the news?
Because yeah, there's certainly an echo chamber of sorts that exists on this in sports journalism, with some of the bigger writers all being kind of aligned one way against the NCAA. And so you'll hear more about the negatives of the stuff than you will the positives, I think, in this case.
Right, and I think, and we'll get into this when we talk about autonomy too, but I think one of the big issues that we have is that we're getting this story through the lens of, I mean, think about who's writing these stories. It's all sports writers.
Right.
It's being treated as a sports story, which in my mind, it isn't really a sports story. It's a story about higher education, and that's the point that the NCAA tried to make. But they either made it really poorly, or they made it to an audience that just didn't want to listen. And I think both are probably true in a lot of cases. And if you watch on, you know, if you're watching Twitter or if you're reading some of these stories, people were more anxious to mock the NCAA than they were to actually consider anything that they were saying.
Yeah, it's gotten ridiculous to the point, and even. What's boggling my mind now are that schools are mocking the NCAA as if the schools themselves aren't the one who vote on and enact these things. You've got this ridiculous stuff like a school reporting that players had too much pasta or that there was too much icing on a cookie cake and stuff like this. Things which are not NCAA violations, but they're self-reporting them in some sort of mocking way, and then that gets latched onto, and you know, people, the average person out there may not be differentiating between what is being done mockingly and what is actually serious, and it's really kind of a sad state of information flow that we have going on right now, because the rush to be humorous or wry or however you want to put it overshadows good journalism a lot of times, I think.
No, I agree. I mean, there's good journalism out there, but it's you just have to wade through so much snark and sarcasm, and it really detracts from. I mean, this is not. People are so anxious to mock the NCAA that they don't even listen. They don't even consider that the NCAA might have a case. And you know, I don't want to fall all over myself defending the NCAA, but there are issues of things like competitive equity. There are issues of academics and the role of athletics for a school's academic profile that need to be made. That just you're listening to people who are treating college sports like any other league, like it was the NFL or the NBA or something. But it's not. They serve a purpose beyond just, you know, just themselves. You know, the schools actually do use them, and that's just not a case. You know, the NCAA just either couldn't make that case clearly or just was making the case to those who didn't want to hear it. But let's talk a little bit about what actually was ruled in the O'Bannon case. Now, you touched on the trust fund for the $5,000 a year trust fund that schools, they don't have to set it up, but they will be can be allowed to set it up for the use of a student athlete's name, image, and likeness.
Sure.
Now, what we aren't going to have is student athletes aren't going to be allowed, based on this particular ruling, they're not going to be allowed to go out and get their own endorsement deals. You're not going to see a bunch of Maryland players going out and doing ads for Eastern Motors or anything like that.
Unfortunately, but, no.
Although, how much would we love to see that anyway? No, but what it is what it is is schools themselves will use a player's name, image, and likeness to promote themselves, and you'll see that player used on television to say, well, you know, Johnny Manziel and Texas A&M are going to be taking on, you know, someone else. But you know what I'm saying? That players are used in the promotion of games themselves and the promotion of the athletic departments. And so what the ruling is that schools can set up these trust funds that can be no less than $5,000 a year. It's not required, but they can. So that upon graduation for the 4 years or however many that the player would be – that their image was being used, they can receive that payout when they leave the school.
Yeah, and it, you know, need to make sure that the distinction's clear between – the ruling is not that schools have to pay players. The ruling is the schools cannot be prevented from paying players this money. So – you know, we could still have a situation where every school in every conference, packed from the SEC all the way down to, you know, the Mountain West and the Sun Belt and all those folks, they could all decide not to do it. But that's probably not going to happen, because then we get into, I think we've talked in the past about product differentiation, and being able to provide a $15,000 a year trust is going to be better than being able to provide no dollars a year trust.
Right. And there were a couple of, you know, looking at another part of the ruling was that schools can't be prohibited from being allowed to provide full cost of attendance scholarships, which on the surface, a lot of people that, you know, they don't see this as that big of a deal, mostly because as part of Power Five autonomy, most of the Power Five, this is kind of what they were driving at anyway. So the ruling is just kind of blesses what was going to be happening, an eventuality. But it still is, you know, that's going to still have a significant impact. And I think, I don't think the NCAA made the case very well. And actually, you know, they didn't make the case very well, because the district court judge Wilkin, when she wrote out her ruling, you know, there are some quotes in there. There's a quote that she said, the high coaches' salaries and rapidly increasing spending on training facilities at many schools suggest that these schools would in fact be able to afford to offer their student athletes a limited share of the licensing revenue generated from their use of the student athletes' own names, images, and likenesses.
Right.
Well, yeah, some schools have high coaches' salaries, but, you know, you're getting a lot of testimony from these SEC powerhouses. You know, if you want to, no one's talking to Louisiana Monroe. You know, no one's talking to 1AA schools and all this. You know, it's a completely different ball. It's a completely different world for these schools. So to say that oh, because look at all the spending on coaches' salaries and training facilities. Well, yeah, at Alabama, but not at, you know, Bethune-Cookman or something. You know, it's completely different. I don't think the NCAA made that case very well. So maybe we should make it for them, Andy. Maybe we need to say right now what the case is, because I just don't think it's something that's been broadcast very well at all. So let's start with this. You know, we hear a lot about the Division I model and the Division III model and what it means. Division I is for schools who basically they want to put themselves in the mainstream. They're looking to raise their profile so that to be more nationally known or to be more regionally known, especially in the case of the FCS schools. So they use athletics as a means to do that. It's usually part of a larger strategic vision for the school to help bring in more applications, to help raise awareness for the school's programs, to get a better, you know, to attract more students and better students so that they can be more selective with who they're allowing in. And also it helps with their own fundraising. Just it brings in some school pride, and so it can bring in more donors, not just for athletics, but for other things too. But it's mostly about raising that profile. Division III is less about sort of advertising for the school, but more for the schools that are trying to enhance the opportunities for their own students at the school. That's more of the traditional kind of it's more of the student experience and less of a profile raiser. But that simple definition for what Division I means never really came out in terms of the impact that it has on a school's academics. And so what you're having here is the costs are going to go up to be able to compete at that Division I level. You're going to have your full cost of attendance. You're going to have this name, image, and likeness benefit. And if the costs are going up to participate, some schools either are going to have to cut things and they're not going to be able to keep up, or they're not going to be able to afford to use athletics to raise that profile. You know, so I think you're, like it or not, you know, there will be people who complain about athletics being the number. I mean, when you think about colleges in the U.S., the first thing you think of are sports. That's just the way it is. So there will be people who will bemoan that fact, but it's just the truth. So schools who want to use that to raise their profile, it's going to be a lot harder to do, and that affects the school's academic profile.
Yeah, and I mean, you see it happen with you know, George Mason in basketball. They saw the bump in applications after they made their run in the NCAA tournament. Yeah, you even see it more with Appalachian State. I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I know that, you know, they got bumps after winning national championships, but they had an even bigger bump by beating Michigan. And that's probably the kind of thing that's driving Appalachian State, which has always been, you know, I grew up in North Carolina. Appalachian State was kind of a, you know, not, I don't want to say an afterthought, but it's certainly in the second tier of schools that people think of when they think of North Carolina, because you think of the four big ACC schools first, and then you think of your Appalachian States and your East Carolinas and your UNC Wilmingtons and things like that, all good schools, but regional, not national. And so Appalachian State sees what they're getting from winning national championships at the FCS level isn't equal to what they got just from winning one game against Michigan. And so now this school that has been a perennial powerhouse in the 1AA/FCS are making that move up to big boy football. And it's not because they want to play big schools more often, because they do that a lot. You know, they don't they're not dreaming. I don't think so. I mean, maybe somebody's got a crazy pipe dream about it, but being the 16th ACC school at some point. But what they're dreaming about is we're going to get on TV every week instead of for the last two rounds of the FCS playoffs if we make it there. And that will immediately raise their profile from regional to more national, or at least super regional, depending on, you know, where their conference gets their games broadcast. So I think people get too hung up on the sports side of things and don't recognize it for what's really driving it. And, you know, people talk about, oh man, you should see Texas's athletic budget for this year. Yeah, it's huge, and it's still a drop in the bucket for what the overall school is spending in a given year.
Right.
So you have that dynamic going on.
Right. Yeah. It's funny. People make the argument that well, look at all these athletic departments. They're making all this money on all these players. Well, colleges make money on every student at the school. It's called tuition. You know, that's what kind of cracks me up is that colleges, if you look at a college's budgets, you know, the athletic department budgets really aren't that big compared to, you know, the school budget at large. And they make money off of every student because the students pay to go there. It just so happens that, you know, some students get to, you know, play a sport in exchange for, you know, their tuition. But that, I think that's getting more into the whole union argument about whether or not student athletes are actually employees. And I don't really want to get it. We'll get into that at some point on a later podcast, but you know, it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough for smaller programs to really survive now. And we talk about O'Bannon, but this really starts getting into more of the Power Five autonomy and what their ultimate goals are, and where this is going to leave everyone else. With the changes that are coming with the autonomy that the Power Five conferences are going to be allowed to make their own rules, they're going to make their own rules to tip the scales towards them. They'll make the argument that it's for the good of student athletes. So sure, it's the full cost of attendance. It's the stipend. Now there are some things that like better medical, like increased medical insurance, that I think we can all kind of agree on. The very purpose of the NCAA when it was first formed was for the safety of the athletes. This is back when people were playing in the Army-Navy game and getting killed with all these flying wedge plays that were where people were getting trampled to death. That's where the NCAA came from. So if more medical insurance, better medical insurance is part of the deal, then I think most people can get behind that, and they should. But when you talk about things like four-year scholarships and full cost of attendance, you know, with a four-year scholarship, it sounds like it would be such a good idea, but most merit-based scholarships aren't for 4 years. If you're getting a scholarship to a school on an academic basis, you have to meet certain requirements in order to renew that scholarship. If you're, you know, if you're not making a certain grade point average or something, that scholarship will be taken from you.
Yeah.
So if similar terms for an athletic scholarship were in place, I don't think that's necessarily so unreasonable. It gets shady when you start getting into, you know, some coaches who will cut players to make room for new guys. I mean, it seems cutthroat and heartless, and I get that. But it's really the full cost of attendance and the more money that schools are going to be allowed to spend on student athletes where the problems are going to come in for the smaller programs.
Yeah. And, you know, to reiterate what you said, that I was a little surprised to find out the lack of some of the long-term health care that was there, you know, when, and you take it all with a grain of salt, but if a if a player is saying that, you know, they told me when I went in for this surgery that this was going to be the last time they paid for it, stuff like that. You hear anecdotes like that, and you say, okay, well then, yeah, we kind of need to change the way that we're thinking about this whole thing. But, you know, as far as the money's concerned, you're right. It is going to kind of create that division there between those who can and those who can't. And
Well, you're right. What's going to end up happening is that, you know, as these rules, this is all going to take time. This is not going to be an immediate switch. You know, there are lots of implications both between O'Bannon and Power 5 autonomy. We still have Title IX issues. We still have future legal hurdles, you know, other lawsuits against the NCAA that are going to come into play, that we don't know how these things are going to play out. So it's going to take time for all these things to start manifesting themselves. But the concern, and the very valid concern, is that, you know, all these Power 5 conferences, they have stacks and stacks of cash coming in from these television contracts. And when you already have the best facilities, when you already pay the most to your coaches, so you have the best coaches, and you start to wonder, how else can we get better? How else can we differentiate ourselves? How else can we beat back the UCFs and the Boise States and the Cincinnatis that are creeping into our exclusive little club and making BCS games and having success? Well, the way you do it, well, if you have all this money, well, let's start giving more to the student athlete. And that way, you know, it becomes a financial consideration, where do I go to Cincinnati and play sooner, or do I go sit on the bench but know that I'm going to be making some money sitting on the bench at Ohio State? So it becomes, a recruit has a very financial decision to make, where it would pay off better to not go to the smaller school. And so what's going to happen is you'll hear Mike Slive say that this is only to create a system that benefits student athletes, but that's not the case at all. And I don't care if he says I'm a cynic to say that, but that's such a disingenuous comment. The goal is to separate themselves more from the little guy. And I think you and I both agree, the end result of this is probably going to be, we're really just delaying in the inevitable. The end result of this is going to be the Power 5 conferences either breaking away, either as an official division within the NCAA umbrella, or just leaving it altogether.
Yeah. That may happen at some point. You know, I know there's been a lot of talk, you know, to kind of take a little detour down the side here with the breakaway talk, in that there has been that discussion of the unofficial breakaway that would be caused if they only scheduled other Power 5 conferences. I don't know if we need to get into that in depth right now, or if you want to talk about that. But, you know, I think it's one of those things that's kind of like when Nick Saban brought it up, and if you've watched anything SportsCenter in the last couple days, basically it seems like a quarter of the time in the morning is dedicated to some Alabama infomercial leading into the launch of the SEC network. And so I think Nick Saban has the biggest microphone right now and is getting picked up. But right before all this autonomy stuff came out, there was a survey done by ESPN, and going to that had a less than 50% of the coaches wanting to do something like that. So, you know, I don't know if that's going to happen to that degree, unless they put themselves in a position where they, like you said, actually leave the NCAA altogether. So, you know, we'll see.
Well, less than 50% want to do it now, but it's not, it's hard to fathom now, just because of the way college football exists now. It's hard to imagine, but you have to look, if you look 10, 20 years down the road and what is kind of forming, you're looking at a situation where you're going to have these Power 5 conferences making so much more money and being able to spend it on their student athletes, where you might have a school like Wake Forest, for example, who right now might have, you know, the lower tier of the Power 5 conferences they can lose schools to recruits to schools like Boise State or East Carolina or something. But they want to make it so that even the lower tier Power Five schools aren't losing those recruits, so that right now there's overlap between the best of the non-Power Five conferences and the worst of the Power Five conferences. The goal is to get rid of that overlap, to make the distinction so clear that they then have an excuse to not play, not play the Group of Five, not engage in anything, really create their own league. Here's the issue that's being faced by those schools that are not in one of the Power Five conferences. So the Power Five, they're going to keep passing these rules that basically enables them to spend more money on their athletes compared to what you see being spent now. And as the smaller budget schools are looking at this, they have a choice they're going to have to make. They're either going to have to go along with these rules and pay their football and basketball athletes the same, but at the expense of other sports. So a lot of Olympic sports are probably looking at some really hard times right now. But if you're a Group of Five school, you know, if you're one of those smaller budget schools that came into Division One for the purpose of, you know, raising your profile for being seen, what choice do you have? You know, you have to go along as you can. So you're going to see Olympic sports start getting the axe, or you're going to see schools finally saying, you know what, we just can't afford to play football anymore. It's not worth it if we're not getting the academic benefit from visibility and our application numbers. So we're going to have to drop out of Division One football or drop down to a lower level. And, again, for a school where the television money and the ticket money from a sport like football can help support some other things, you're again going to be faced with hard choices. So I think you're going to find – I know Mike Oresko mentioned that the American is behind this, and we're going to press forward because we have resources too, and we're going to move on. He has to say that because his whole point that he's trying to make is that we're a power conference too, so he has to kind of go along with whatever the power conferences want. But I don't know how long it's going to be able to last. You know, it's going to the rules are going to start coming, and as they come down, it's just going to be more and more expensive with each new rule that they pass. And I don't know how long schools are going to be able to hold out.
Yeah, I mean, you look, and it's not even just in a conference like the American. You look at some of the schools that are treading water in the Power Five conferences out there. I mean, NC State just broke ground, was it today or yesterday, on an indoor practice facility. Finally were able to get the $17 million or $15 million, whatever it was, raised to be able to build that. And they also, they don't have a ton of Olympic sports there either. I mean, you know, the NC State used to have a pretty decent lacrosse team back in the day until they gave up the ghost back in the early 80s. This is going to have an impact at some other levels too, I think, unless we see the contracts for those conferences continue to ramp up.
Well, and they're expecting it too. You know, you see reports where, you know, I think the Big Ten's television contract expires to 2016, 2017, mm-hmm. and they're expecting $40 million. You know, the money's just going to keep going up and up and up. And I think, you know, the other conferences they roll out later than that. I think the last one is the ACC and maybe 2026, 2027, I think.
Yeah, ACC's weird. They seem to have, like, language in their contract that allows them to renegotiate like every other year.
Okay, but know?
Like one thing happens and they renegotiate.
But the money is going to get bigger. So sure. I've heard a lot of arguments. I've read a lot of comments that where people think, well, look, there's you know, we can't all, you know, it's not going to be just about the Power Five breaking away, because there are Power Five schools that don't have the budget to be able to do what some of the larger schools want to do. But I don't think that's really going to be the case in the long run, because the money's going to keep on coming. You know, the money is going to be there. There's going to be more money. They're going to be able to afford to do it. And you have to remember, they're not looking to get Wake Forest to compete with Florida State. They're looking to get Wake Forest to beat ECU, to beat Boise State, you know, to beat the schools that aren't in that in theory won't be able to spend this kind of money. Because I think what you're looking at, I think the way this is all going to play out is that once the Power Five schools, they don't fear Boise State, they don't fear UCF, but they're annoyed by them. You know, they're annoyed when UCF beats the Big 12 champ in a BCS bowl game. You know, they're annoyed when USF rises to as high as number 2 in the nation. They're annoyed by Boise State's success, because there's a. That's not the bird dog. That's Andy's dog. But the power conferences have been able to justify things like the BCS, and they justify setting themselves apart. And you even hear it again. They say, well, we're the schools that win 90% of the championships. You know, we're the best. But the more other schools rise up and they're able to show that they can compete, it takes away from that argument. So they want to get to the point where these schools can't compete, where even Duke and Wake Forest and Vanderbilt, you know, the traditional programs that have always struggled, you know, they're able to offer so much more to a recruit that a recruit would be foolish not to choose a lesser Power Five school over a Group of Five school that right now is a better program, but they just won't be able to compete and to offer as much financially to a recruit. And once you reach that point, then you can really start seeing the money come in. Because remember, television drives all of this, right? So you have, if you remember the last round of conference expansion, all that came about because conferences were looking to add value to their next television contracts. They were looking to bring in the big schools, to bring in the big media markets, so that when they go to the negotiating table for their television contracts, they're in a position of strength where they'll be able to get more. That's not really happening now. You look at, you know, who's left? BYU, maybe. But there aren't too many schools out there where these Power Five conferences can go out and grab them to bring in more money. You know, maybe UConn to the ACC, but even then, you're starting to get into some pretty, you know, it's questionable how much these schools will really bring in an additional value.
I think that Navy's got a better shot at that spot than UConn.
Well, I don't know.
Navy's shot is one in a million.
Yeah, I'll agree with the one in a million part. I don't know about that.
I say the only, just as a quick aside, the only way that Navy ever moves up into a scenario like that is if they do make this Power Five break and Power Five only schedules, and Notre Dame says to the ACC, yeah, okay, we'll do that. We'll come and be full time in the ACC for football, but only if you bring Navy with us.
Yeah, we all the pipe dreams. It's a pipe dream episode of the Bird Dog podcast.
I love pipe dreams. They're fun. But anyway, I digress.
Yes, but anyway. And so there aren't too many schools outside of the Power Five conferences when it comes time to renegotiate these contracts. There aren't any other schools that they're really going to be able to bring in other than maybe BYU. And I don't think with all the grants of rights that we've agreements that we've seen in the ACC and the Big 12, it's becoming less of a, you know, you're looking at some legal entanglements if you want to go raid another power conference, like if the if the Big Ten wanted to go after Georgia Tech or UNC or something. So, you know, it doesn't look like that's going to happen unless you wanted to spend $30 million apiece, and that defeats the whole purpose.
Yeah, I was going to say Maryland just paid $31.5 million to get out of the ACC, and they didn't even have the grant of rights that is in place there now. So,
Right. So if you can't go out and get new teams to add to your television contract, then what you really have to do is make the teams you have better. And if you can make the Duke Wake Forest game, you know, if you can make that more valuable, then you don't have to, you know, that's really what you have left. Because if your Alabamas, your USCs, your Texases, they are what they are. They're not going anywhere. But if you can get the other schools better and raise their profile, then that's how you can make some more money. And you do that, and you can do that by setting, you know, casting off these Boise States and UCF so that they can't financially compete. And then once you can set that apart, then you can kind of break away. And just imagine if you expand a playoff to 16 teams, have nothing but the Power 5 conferences play in like an NFL-style league. You don't worry about going undefeated anymore because your conferences basically become divisions. And so you can win your division at, you know, 9-3 or something and make the playoffs and off you go. It becomes an NFL model. But imagine the money that you'd have for that. I mean, it would be huge. And I think that's really what they're going to end up moving towards. And I think at that point you start to wonder, you know, you start to wonder where everyone else is going to go. You know, Mike Slav can say that he's doing this for his student athletes. You know, that's great, but by doing this, you're probably going to take away the opportunities of way more student athletes than the ones you're supposedly benefiting. So it's a tough pill to swallow.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's our vision for doom and gloom for the future. Let's move on to other disturbing topics. Let's talk a little bit about Air Force. The Colorado Springs Gazette ran a story last weekend detailing some of the issues at with the Air Force athletic program. It touched a lot on the cadet informant stuff that we heard. Was that almost a year ago now? I don't even remember when that story originally ran. But it was a while back.
I think it was over the winter, or maybe early spring, something like that. Anyway.
Yeah, there was a mix of some new things and a mix of not really rehashing the things that we heard back then, but sort of amplifying that and giving us a few more details. Now we read the story and some of the follow-ups, but as far as the original story, Andy, I think you and I both had some problems with the original article as it ran.
Yeah, there were definitely points there for which we could take umbrage. You know, leaping off the top of the page to me was throwing out things about like coaches' pay and comparing it to how much the Secretary of Defense makes. And,
yeah, that's some, you know, some populist garbage right there.
Yeah, and those are the canards that every writer seems to tack on to a story like this, whether it's, you know, taxpayers are paying to put these kids through, and when they get kicked off the team, it costs them hundreds of thousands of dollars, ignoring the fact that 25% of the people from a class, well, now that the schools are all soft, they don't have that high of an attrition rate. But
yeah, you know. Last real plebe year, anyway.
but back when we had real plebe summers, anyway, that's baked in. That's a sunk cost,
right?
And so putting these canards out there on a story that actually has some meat just does such a disservice to the writers. By them just trying to get some big broad brush to paint it with.
Right. So what the article was trying to make the argument for was that, look at all this money that's going into the athletic department, and with all this money that's being spent on here, there's a lot of pressure to produce a winner, and in order to produce a winner, they have to lower standards to do blah, blah, blah. And, you know, they try to make the money argument, and other than stating the coach's salary, they don't make the connection. They just state it and then leave it. And I thought that was pretty weak from as far as the article goes, I mean, yeah, Troy Calhoun makes $800,000 a year, great, but you know, that's low for, you know, 1A football. You know, that's nothing huge. So you know, simply stating that fact, it isn't making an argument.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of coaches out there that have been paid more than $400,000 a win. Boom.
Yeah, it's
Nick Saban probably makes $400,000 a win too.
Oh, the low blow from Schmickle.
Yes.
There are a couple other things I didn't like. They brought in this guy. You know, whenever there's someone who wants to talk about Surface Academy athletics going wrong, there's always someone willing to make their comment. You know, we have our Fleming. They found this Robert Goldich fellow, who makes the claims that alumni are, quote, so rah-rah about football that they don't care about what happens, unquote, off the field. Who are these alumni? You know, they bring in this one guy who says this. Who are these people who don't care? It's so shoddy. It's like they just throw that out there, and then that's it. Here you go.
It's again. You're damaging your own story by having throwing this stuff in. You come in, you introduce this guy. Oh, he's a congressional researcher from Virginia, as if those credentials are supposed to blow me away. Is he from the state of Virginia? Is he at the University of Virginia? What's going on? And then he gets two quotes that are just basically lobbing grenades out there with no context around it. And then he's gone, and that's it. And it's like, you know, and bless him for using the rah-rah term, because that just makes me think of like guys in suits and bowler hats sitting in the stands smoking cigars watching Army Navy in the 1900s. Because I don't know how many people actually talk about rah-rah on a daily basis here, but just stick to the meat of the story and stop spending so much time trying to get other muck to stick to a program, because there's enough here that can be talked about with what's going on in the administration of the athletics and of the players, that you don't need to get into all this other stuff.
Right. I think I think that, you know, the article itself was trying to take a huge swing where, and you know you'll read people respond to that, you know, that's what gets attention, so I get it. But I think, you know, as someone who you know, as an observer of Surface Academy football, I think they did themselves a disservice trying to bite off more than they could chew. You know, they made a bigger case than what they really had an argument for. They tried to make arguments instead of stating facts, and the facts that they had didn't tie in to the arguments that they made, and they just filled it with quotes from this one guy where, you know, and some salary figures, and that didn't really, I wasn't very impressed by that. And the other thing that bothered me was the way that the article characterized prep schools. Now, yeah. I'll preface this by saying we don't know how the Air Force Academy has been using their prep school, so there might be some meat there. I know we've heard anecdotally about some really high attrition rates at their prep school, so that may suggest that they're, you know, something about the pitch that they're giving these guys or who's they're admitting to their prep school, but we don't know that. What bothers me is that they cast, but that's not really where they didn't try to dig into that, and they didn't make that case, but they just characterized prep schools in general, and they used really charged language, calling it, and we've heard this term before, but calling it a backdoor into the academy. And that bothers me, because it implies that there's something sinister about the way prep schools are used. And I'm going to get on my soapbox here and talk a little bit about what service academies are, what the prep school means, and how, you know, you have to understand when you look at that academy admissions, it's not as simple as just taking the guys with a 1,000 highest SAT scores and saying, there you go, those are the guys that are going to go in and serve the country. That's not what it is. You have to try to find who has aptitude for leadership, and you also have to understand that these, when you look at school systems across the country, they're not all the same. It's a this. School systems in Florida are not the same as Ohio, or not the same as in California. It is wide-ranging, and if you're a service academy that has to recruit nationally, that has to accept kids nationally, you know, you have to, how do you even that playing field? How do you take someone who could very well have an aptitude for leadership but comes from a crappy school system, or doesn't have or didn't take calculus, or whatever? Well, that's how you send them to the prep school. You're not admitting a bunch of dummies into here, but you're admitting people who you think have the potential for leadership, who can and use the prep school to make up for these deficiencies that you have. Either, you know, sure, some of their grades might be lower, but who do you want to be? Who do you want to be your leader of troops? Okay, do you want the guy with the 1600 SAT who's in the chess club, or do you want the guy with the 1150 SAT who's captain of the wrestling team and, you know, did community service and XYZ? You know, the answer is that you might want both, but you yeah. but there are some people who think that the only guy who should be admitted is that guy with the perfect SAT score. And that's not the way, you know, that's not how you find leaders. You have to understand, surface academies have a mission. They aren't academics for academia's sake. It's not just an institution to grant degrees. It's an institution with a mission to find people who have we memorize the mission of the academy. You know, you want to have people who have the aptitude to serve as leaders in the military, as leaders in government and in the community. And you can't, it's not just people who get good grades who do that. And let's not pretend like people are getting bad grades getting into these prep schools either. It's people who might need a refresher on some classes, might need some, you know, to just get a boost to pick up their SAT scores a little bit. But it's not like they're coming in as like these NCAA minimum qualifying standards or anything. So I don't like the characterization of prep schools as a back door. They are vital to creating, to crafting academy classes that will go on and serve as the core of the career officers in the military.
Right. You know, just, I want to touch one more time on, you know, the mission of the Naval Academy. They said, you know, we memorize not just the part about being leaders, but right off the bat, it's to develop midshipmen morally, mentally, and physically. It's not to admit those who are already at the highest morality, the highest mentality, and the highest physicality. If it was all about being as in shape as you could be, there's no way I would have gotten in the Naval Academy, because I was a little soft around the edges when I got in there. But they developed me that way, the same way that they take people and they develop guys who might not have been the best students, but showed the aptitude to adapt and learn and graduate and go on to lead. And you know, it's one of those things that I think it's lost in the mix a lot, when the only people who are really speaking out about it are those who are your Fleming types who just constantly harp on this
who basically standard. Yeah, they basically say that the 1,000 best SAT scores and GPAs, that's who you get in. And if that's the case, then you don't need an admissions board. You just need a spreadsheet. Just throw everyone on there, filter by, you know, SAT scores, and then off you go. But it's way more complicated than that. You have to look at blue and gold officers and their input. You have to look at interviews and the whole picture. And, you know, you want someone who has... You know, if you look at what determined, I mean, I'm not going to pretend like I was a great mid. I'm not going to pretend like I was, you know, some fantastic naval officer. But you can see who the successful guys are. The successful guys are the ones who have a good work ethic. And you can sometimes a guy who has, you know, a 4.0 GPA, maybe that's indicative of a good work ethic. It could very well be. But the guy who's a great athlete could also have a good work ethic. You know, you just want to make sure that the academic all-star is, you know, physically develops himself enough to handle, you know, the challenging, you know, stressful environment, but you also want to make sure that the athlete is mentally sound enough to handle the mental challenges of the mental rigors of the naval service. So, you know, but there's room for both. That's the point. But for some reason, people only look at one and they think the one at the detriment of the other, and that's not the case at all. It's you want the best people with the best potential, and that doesn't necessarily mean the people with the top grades. And that's why I take issue with characterizing prep schools as back doors. They're not back doors. They are vital. And we all know, you know, some of the best officers and certainly some of the best mids came from the prep school. So yes. That really bothered me when they characterized that. Now, all that being said, there were some things in here that there were some points made, and there were some things that really make you kind of a little uneasy about what's happening at the Air Force Academy. You know, we talked about the informant articles of months past. We didn't know really in the extent of some of the things that we heard about. Like, we knew that Jamil Cooks was separated from the Air Force Academy, and how he was court-martialed, but we didn't know the details of that story.
Yeah.
And we've heard that some guys we didn't even hear that they had left the team. They're just not on the roster anymore, we find out. And then now we find out why. Bad things are going to happen whenever you're in service academies, are no exceptions. Guys are going to do things that are wrong, and you'll have to deal with them, but it's, you know, it's never going to not happen. There will always be situations where these things happen, but there's a difference between talking about dealing with events and dealing with a culture. And this is really the second time in the last 10 years that we've had questions of culture coming up at the Air Force Academy. You'll remember in 2003 they had they call it the Agenda for Change, and there's a big issue with sexual assault at the Air Force Academy, and part of the findings from this agenda was that it was felt that the athletic department at the school was too powerful, and people were intimidated by it. So what ended up happening was that the school reorganized so that the athletic director was actually, it didn't report to the superintendent anymore. It reported to their equivalent of a commandant. And yeah, the Air Force AD at the time was Randy Spetman, who was actually he was a colonel, and he was actually higher ranking than the commandant at the time, and he resigned over it. But they felt like they had to knock the athletic department down a peg because of it, because it was too powerful at the school. And I think you're looking at a situation where I don't know if that's the same case, but you know, again, it's that culture where of how athletics fit in. And there are a lot of comments in here that I found to be pretty telling. You know, one of the steps that their superintendent said that they needed to make to correct their issues now is to, and this is a quote from the article, that demanding that cadets buy into a culture of commitment. That sticks out to me because
that's the whole point of going to a service academy.
Yeah, they didn't already.
A commitment.
Yeah, they yes. didn't already. What were they buying into? But then, well, let's get back to that. Let's take a step back. So we're dealing with a series of events over time. We're looking at these we had some pretty graphic descriptions of these parties and talking about putting roofies in drinks, and that's was very disturbing. But then there are two things here. There is the drug use and these parties and sexual assault, that, and then there is also an academic component. I thought that some of the academic arguments that they brought up were kind of weak. Not that there wasn't anything there, just that I didn't find that the arguments that they made were necessarily that compelling. They talked a lot about, you know, they talked a lot about, you know, we knew about the cheating on that one math test, and they said, well, I don't remember the exact numbers, but there were 70 cadets, we'll say, who got caught cheating, and a large number were athletes. Well, you're talking about a school where a quarter of the population in general is athletes. So any situation that encompasses a wide swath of the population is going to include some athletes, just by sheer numbers. So I don't
think this isn't a North Carolina situation where they had fake classes that were 95% athletes, where athletes make up like 4% of the school population. This is,
well, we don't, I mean, I think what I'm trying to say is, we don't, if there was something, they didn't really make the argument here.
Right. Yeah, sure. They didn't prove. Yeah, they didn't.
Right. Because if, you know, when you have so many athletes as part of, you know, such a, it's a 4,000 student school, and then they said something like 1,000 were athletes. Well, if that's the case, anything that cuts a cross section of a student population is going to involve athletes. So you can't really use that as an indictment of the athletic department to say that, well, you know, X number of student athletes got caught up in this cheating exam. Yeah, shame on them, but that doesn't necessarily point the finger at the athletic department necessarily. Now, that other class, you know, they talked about that one class for the two basketball players. That might be a little shady. I just feel like I need more information before I make that call. It seems unusual. I will give you that. But, you know, there's a difference between changing the standard that a student has to meet, as opposed to saying that, you know, reducing the standard that a student has to meet. You know, if a student is still expected to take a certain class and he takes it in an unorthodox way, as opposed to, you know, somehow getting by, like you were saying with the North Carolina situation, I think there's a difference between the two. So I would be willing to listen to that, but I think there just has to be more shown before I can really, you know, get too spun up over the things that I read on the academic side.
I think plenty of mids out there during their time at school may have seen instances where athletes in their class might have been, you know, doing a lot of makeup work or work on the road because their schedules weren't fitting well with what the class schedule was. And I would much rather put athletes into a class that fits in their schedule and allows them to learn than to force them into a set schedule that's going to be detrimental to their learning. So like you said, there's information that needs to be had about this. It's not the worst thing ever. I'm willing to give them a little bit of the benefit of a doubt, which is a pretty huge step for me.
Congratulations. And, we're all happy for you.
Thank you. So again, TBD, I guess, is the best thing to say about that.
Right. I mean, there might be something there, but I would have to see more to before I you know, that really, you know, it leads me to ask more questions, but I'm not drawing any conclusions based on what we saw from the academic side. Now, the other stuff, we had heard about the you know, some of the drug use, and we've heard about some of the sexual assault back when the informant stories came out. But we didn't really hear the extent necessarily. And we this kind of, and a lot of this is confirmation of things we kind of figured, but we never really knew. Like, we would see guys drop off the roster and get no explanation for them. Or we would hear things like when Jamil Cooks went to, was court-martialed, you know, that wasn't reported in the sports page. That was reported in the Gazette's military section. You know, it was buried. You know, it's just not something that we heard about. So we're getting the more the extent, and you know, it's you know, we can say that it that there's a problem, but what we say, you know, what does it really matter? We don't know. What catches my eye is that their superintendent is saying that there's a problem, and they're saying we need to change the kind of person that we're recruiting. And when I hear something like that, it kind of blows me away. You know, that's what points more than anything to a cultural issue, and it points a finger, I think, at their previous administration. I think it makes Mike Gould look really bad, but I also think it makes Troy Calhoun look really bad. And I'm, you know, looking at some of his quotes in the article, they struck me as disingenuous and self-serving, and it explains a lot of things that we've seen from him over the past few years, like his media policies.
Yeah, and to what's amazing is that the level of the disingenuous content of his comments has only increased in the days since this article came
out. It's been unbearable.
It is. I mean, it's getting to be where the, and I don't think this is over the line to say this, but it's getting to be where, like, the sports pages of the Gazette are Troy Calhoun's personal Pravda, where he gets to say whatever he wants and couch situations however he wants and gets virtually no pushback on it. And I mean, to get out there and to be framing, hitting in pads, to being in like hand-to-hand combat and killing people with bayonets is just so far beyond the pale that I mean, I know you say it all the time. How do people continuously fall for this guy's shtick? It's unbearable, and it's unconscionable given the little microcosm that he exists in now after all this information came out public. Like, to continue to try to be this fake guy that he is, you know, Dave Christensen, we hardly knew ye, we apologize for all the bad mouth that you got.
Well, we don't. We loved him.
Well, we loved it, but we as the public in general should be looking at what happened after that game and how he got lambasted for what he did.
He said mean things to a service academy coach. How dare he?
It's just, I mean, it's every day. And if it's not that, it's today the you know, the Gazette ran a little puff piece on Gould and being on the playoff selection committee and all this kind of stuff, and it had a throwaway in there where it was basically like, well, when we asked him about, you know, the allegations that came out in this, he declined to comment. So, but I am really excited about being part, and that was it. That's like investigative reporting, you know, really really hitting hard there, and you know, we're 8 days removed.
Do you have any doubt that Troy Calhoun knew what was, maybe not every single situation, but when I look at when he set these really restrictive media policies and restricted access he restricted media access to Air Force players, and he really limited the amount of media exposure that the program had, it had to be over this, didn't it? I mean, it had to be. He had to know, you know, this all started, I guess, you know, 4 or 5 years ago now, and
because he wasn't always like this.
No,
it wasn't always like that. And I remember the rat. I don't. It was that during Frank Schwab's time?
No, it was Jake Schaller. It was
Jake Schaller.
Yeah, it happened, and Schaller wrote, when he actually wrote, like, I don't get it. This makes no sense. I have no idea why he's doing this. And I think now we have an idea why. He wanted to keep this out. Because if you think about it, you know, Coach Niumatalolo, at Media Day, he was asked about recruiting and you know, the kinds of things that he had. He was asked about whether or not the Notre Dame wins helped with recruiting. He was like, yeah, they did. They helped get exposure for us. But lots of things helped get exposure for us. And he talked about how open the program was. He talked about doing all the social media stuff with the videos on YouTube, like those Brotherhood videos, which were awesome.
Oh, yeah.
He talked about the Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and how open the program was. You compare, and he's right, you know, the best thing that if you're a service academy coach, you know, the best recruiting tool that you have are your own players, because recruits can see your own players and see, hey, these guys aren't G.I. Joe. They're just normal guys, and they feel like they can fit into that. You know, getting in, the more recruits are exposed to your school and the earlier that they're exposed to your school, they can see that, yeah, it's a military environment, but it's also a college. And you have to see that. It's not a four-year boot camp. It's a college. And you can't underestimate the kind of misconceptions that are out there. So the more you can do to fight that, the better off you are in recruiting. You know, it helps you. So it makes no sense for Troy Calhoun to be so restrictive with the media. You know, he's not Alabama. He's Air Force. He needs every amount of exposure for his program that he can get, and for him to limit that makes no sense unless he's worried about what they'll find. And right. I think now we're looking at the case where I think he was worried about what they would find, so he was cutting it off, and he'd use excuses like, oh, academics, you know, I don't want you to interview the players, they have academic concerns. Yeah,
right.
I mean, it was
right when they're on the road at a football game. They can't do an interview before they get on the plane to fly home because they've got papers to write.
Right. Yeah, it was.
Come on.
And that's another thing. He says things like academics because no one wants to question that. Like, that's perceived as a good, so no one questions, oh, academics. Oh. He must really care about these things because he's Captain America Troy Calhoun.
It's a vortex of enablement that surrounds him because he's untouchable because of the military, because he went to the academy, because he coaches kids in academy, because he can throw out something like academics, or he can throw out something about going to war. Not good credit, but bad credit, the guy that he realized that he could warp this whole situation into a bubble that he could, you know, exist in where he controls the message.
Right. He wouldn't be able to get away with this at any other school. He can get away with it because Colorado Springs is kind of isolated, has one and a half, because sometimes the Denver Post, you know, writes an article or two on him. But for the most part, he's got one paper covering him, and it's in Colorado Springs, which is not in a, you know, Eastern media hub. So he knows what he can get away with, and basically he does. I think this whole situation really, you know, when you put his media policies in light of all this, I think it makes him look really bad. I think a lot of this old blood and guts routine that he's doing right now, saying, oh, we have hard practices because we need to see if guys are ready for combat, some of the most ridiculous things you could ever read. I think he's pouring it on thick now because I think he feels like he has to save face. I think with all this stuff that's coming out, he has to say, oh no, I'm all about, you know, admitting leaders of character and combat leaders and, you know, what training combat blah blah, you know, whatever. He says that, but, you know, I don't, you know, it's very obvious to me what he's doing. But the one quote from the article that really stuck out at me was when the superintendent said that that she is demanding that cadets buy into a culture of commitment. When you, you know, think about that, if you're trying to get people to buy into a culture of commitment, how can you do that when the person recruiting you spent the majority of his time in the Air Force as a football coach? What is it that you're buying into? And I think all this ties together. We've talked a lot about how, you know, you look at the composition of the Air Force coaching staff under Calhoun, it's had such a high number of academy grads, and almost all of them were football coaches for if not a majority, a very significant part of their active duty time. And When you talk about a culture of commitment, what are you selling recruits? You know, you hate to take what recruit comments too seriously, because they're recruits. They don't really know even mids that are at the academy for a couple of years don't know everything that's going on. So you don't want to take what they say, you know, too seriously. But they've had recruits, and we've linked to them, where they had one recruit, Brad Padillo from Hawaii, went to the Air Force Academy and said, well, you know, I'm choosing Air Force because I want nothing to do with war. And if I go to Navy, there's a better chance I'm gonna end up that. So I'm going to go to Air Force. Now, I don't fault a kid for wanting nothing to do with war. I think most normal people want nothing to do with war. We all pray that it doesn't happen. That's fine. I get that. But it's a little strange for you to say that and then say, but I'm going to commit to a service academy.
Right.
Where does he get that idea? There's only one place he could have possibly gotten that idea, and that's from the people recruiting him. They had to be telling them that, and they can show it to him. They can say, look, I coached. I went to the Air Force Academy, and I was a coach for 4 years after that. So don't worry, kid. Come to Air Force. And if that's the culture of commitment that you're selling, I think you can't. If what you're really concerned about a culture of commitment, about committing to what the institution means and committing to service, then you can't do that. You're not going to get that from a football coach who's, not that I have anything wrong with coaching, but that's not what you were put on the uniform to do. And if that's, you're not, where's the commitment coming from? I think that speaks to it right there, and that's a very underappreciated aspect of this entire story.
Yeah, I mean, there's not really much else to say to that. Pretty much hits the nail on the head. We've always made the comments about the combat coaches that come through Air Force and have so much coaching experiences, tour of duties for themselves, and it's kind of rearing its head now. I don't know. I don't know any way to put it better than what you just did.
Well, and I wonder, it makes you wonder, is Troy Calhoun's job in jeopardy? You know, is this something, you know, and you actually made the point when we were talking about this last week, you know, Air Force is in the process of looking for a new athletic director.
Yeah.
Who knows how this is going to affect, you know, their candidate pool for who's going to take the job. You know, obviously someone will. But who's really going to want this? You have their superintendent of the school saying, "We have to look at who you guys are recruiting," meaning that it's probably going to, you know, they're not going to have as wide a pool as they've apparently been drawing from. They've had all these budget cuts that are coming in. So how many prospective ADs are going to want this job? Not too many. But whoever does come in, is that person going to have any loyalty to Troy Calhoun? I don't know. You know, with all this other stuff going on, with budget cuts and with, you know, how many of these problems, you know, we don't know what this IG investigation that the soup ordered is going to reveal, but if problems like this point to the football coach, then you got to wonder, you know, is Troy Calhoun's job at risk? Now, it might be at risk.
I mean, I think that
he goes 2-10 again, then it might be at risk anyway, but...
Yeah, I mean, I would think that any sort of finger pointed at him, coupled with how last season went, what's happened in the past, you know, what's happening right now, if they don't, you know, if he doesn't do a big turnaround, then it's pretty much just carte blanche for a new AD to do as he wishes. You know, if there's anything that comes out from the IG inspection that has a finger even remotely pointed in the direction of Steph. Yeah, you know, it's his position is tenuous right now, to say the least.
Yeah, so I think we're in agreement that reading the article and some of the aftermath, that we don't necessarily think that everything that the article is saying, you know, we think the article kind of makes an argument that isn't necessarily there, kind of takes this a step farther than it should, but we do both kind of agree that the superintendent and Troy Calhoun's actions, both of their actions kind of point to the fact that something is wrong, and things are going to change at the Air Force Academy, and it's probably, you know, you don't want to talk too much about how it will affect things on the field, because I think these are these are bigger issues that should transcend any on-field effects. But change is coming at the Air Force Academy, and I don't think this is a story that's going to go away. I think this one's going to have a little bit of staying power. So, anyway, any last thoughts, Andy? We've been going at this for a while. We might want to quit while before we get our next technical hiccup.
Yeah, that's probably a good thing. We can talk more about actual Navy football stuff at our next rodeo. I think that much like the whole issue with O'Bannon and autonomy and Power Five, this Air Force is, there's a lot of stuff out there right now, but there's a lot of, we need to see how it develops before we really have an idea of what kind of long-lasting ramifications it's going to have. But I got to tell you, man, I've never been a fan of Troy Calhoun's, to put it mildly, but what he's done since this article has come out, it's just been, it's been nothing short of deplorable. And
no, there needs to be a separate Twitter account just for ridiculous Troy Calhoun quotes, yeah. Because it's some of this stuff.
It doesn't even have to be fake. You don't need a faux Pelini. You've got actual
Troy Calhoun. But I mean, it's so over the top. It's ridiculous. But anyway, this has been a downer podcast because we're talking about the end of college athletics as we know it and horrible things happening at the Air Force Academy, which neither one of us are fans of Air Force, but we don't exactly revel in this stuff either. I would like to see Troy Calhoun just stop saying ridiculous quotes, but, you know, life goes on. Anyway, so this has been a downer podcast. I think we're going to try to do a bit of a Service Academy preview coming up, talk about the fun stuff, the actual football. So we'll try to get to that at the next podcast. But for now, we'll wrap things up. Don't forget, thanks for listening, by the way, you know, especially bearing with the technical difficulties this time around. Don't forget that you guys can follow me on Twitter at @NavyBirdDog, and you can follow Andy on Twitter at @GoalieLax. And thank you for listening, and we'll hopefully have something less technically deficient next time around. You can blame Andy for that one.
That's all my fault.
Yeah.
It's actually my dog's fault, but have a good night, everybody.
All right. Thanks, everyone.